The main character of our first story is currently under nearly 9,000 feet of water. It's the MS Prinsendam. It was a Holland-America cruise ship that left the Northwest in the fall of 1980. There were 324 passengers aboard and 200 crew members, and they were on the adventure of a lifetime, a trip across the Pacific Ocean that would eventually take them to Japan. But the Prinsendam never made it. It sank in the Gulf of Alaska. But here's the thing. Every single person aboard survived in what is considered the largest high seas rescue in maritime history. Maybe one of the luckiest, too. 88.5's Ed Ronco has the story.
There are movies about disasters at sea. Movies designed to heighten the drama and tell an unforgettable story.
We've got to stay here till help arrives.
Help from where? From the captain? He's dead.
I would argue that movies like that have nothing on the real-life sinking of the MS Prinsendam. Nothing.
By the time of the Prinsendam, I had almost died a violent death at least a dozen times because of the way I was doing with my life.
John Graham was a foreign service officer for the U.S. government. It's the kind of job where you travel the globe, but you're not always welcomed, and sometimes you have to leave countries in a hurry. I met up with him at a reunion of survivors and rescuers held in Seattle on the 35th anniversary of the disaster. In the fall of 1980, John had just been hired as part of the ship's entertainment staff. He was going to use his background in foreign service to give a couple of lectures on the trip to Japan.
And it turned out after the first night, part of my job also was to waltz blue-haired widows around the dance floor, but I didn't know that then.
More than 300 passengers were aboard, some of them perhaps blue-haired widows. John brought his then 13-year-old daughter Mallory along for the trip, and after 3 days of traveling up Alaska's Inside Passage, Mallory had just gone to sleep in her cabin when an announcement came over the ship's loudspeakers. Smoke in the engine room. Nothing too serious, though, they said. They're working to clear it out. So Mallory went back to bed.
And then a little bit later on, my dad woke me up. And there was another announcement that, oh, well, we haven't been able to clear out the smoke, so we're doing live entertainment and free food up on the Lido deck.
Up on deck, entertainers were performing selections from a Rodgers and Hammerstein review.
Oklahoma, where the wind comes sweeping down the plain.
On some level, it might have been good in terms of there was no panic among the passengers. Everyone was fairly calm. But we really had no idea that anything was wrong.
Beneath them, something was very wrong. A fire in the engine room, and it was growing.
So suddenly, it was no longer, there's no problem, there's just a little smoke. It was, we were outside, and I could see the flames at the other side of the ship.
The order came to get into the lifeboats. Mallory, her father John, and more than 500 others, passengers and crew, began piling in.
The fact that there were almost 90 people in a lifeboat designed for 45, or I think 47 it said, meant that we were warmer, because no one had warm clothes.
Or medications, or provisions. They just got into the boats. While they were doing that, the call for help went out, and the response was massive. Two nearby ships, three Coast Guard cutters, some of their crews awakened or even pulled out of bars in Juneau in the middle of the night, and aircraft from the Coast Guard, the U.S. Air Force, and the Royal Canadian Air Force. As daylight arrived, John and Mallory were awaiting rescue in lifeboat number 2.
I remember once, shortly before noon, a crewman, who should have known better, got up in the middle of that lifeboat and he shouted at the top of his lungs in broken English that we were all going to die. He just kind of completely lost it. And a woman from New Jersey, from one of New Jersey's oldest, finest families, I know because I'd waltzed her around the dance floor the night before, she got up and she belted this guy in the face. She said, "How dare you? Sit down and shut up." And he did, and that averted a moment of panic.
Soon the rescuers arrived. So did a storm, the remnants of Typhoon Vernon. The seas are churning. Lifeboats are riding out each new wave, rising and falling, rising and falling, rising and falling. People are getting sick. Three Coast Guard cutters have arrived, along with an oil tanker and another ship. There are planes flying overhead as spotters. Rescue crews have been dropped into the lifeboats to take charge in clearing them out, and helicopters are plucking people one by one from below and ferrying them to a waiting rescue vessel.
A helicopter came over our lifeboat, and they sent down a metal basket, and they took one person up one at a time. And the movie Star Wars had just come out, right? So it had just been out a couple years earlier. And the man who was hauling up the basket was wearing a white helmet and an orange jumpsuit. And I was sure that I was being rescued by Luke Skywalker.
Below, John watched his 13-year-old daughter lifted away from him in a dangling metal chair. Soon, the storm grew worse. The helicopters could no longer fly, and now John and seven others were left in the boat, waiting in the dark for help.
We were ready to die. We knew the odds were that we were going to die. If I had to die then, these were a good seven people to die with.
As the storm intensified, the remaining passengers on lifeboat number two saw the Coast Guard cutter Boutwell crashing toward them through the waves. John Graham caught a line from the cutter and tied it off. The ocean heaved and the line ripped away a side of the lifeboat. Crewmen from the cutter lowered something called a horse collar. It's a rescue strap on the end of a huge pole. And one by one, the people aboard the lifeboat positioned the collar underneath their arms and around their backs. The time for polite hoisting was over.
These guys on decks would all heave as hard as they could. And we'd go flying off through the air. So like we were like a piece of tuna or a tuna. We kept flying through the air, flopping down on the deck.
Finally, John was aboard the Boutwell, bruised, cold, but alive. John was taken to Sitka. Mallory aboard a different vessel went to Valdez and then Anchorage, some 600 miles away from her dad.
And I was totally, alone on my own. I didn't know anyone. And when I think about that at the time and being 13 years old, I was like, wow. But, you know, you've also just been in, 30-foot seas, been throwing up over the side of a lifeboat. So at that point, you're like, well, okay, whatever comes next, I can do this.
They were reunited in Seattle a few days later. Last year, Mallory and John reunited with many of their rescuers at Coast Guard Base Seattle. Mallory says, as a result, she now has a Facebook feed filled with Coast Guard retirees, people with whom she has very little in common, except for the fact that they rescued her. Mallory and John both live in Western Washington today. Mallory in Seattle, John is on Whidbey Island, and they've both been on cruises since their brush with maritime disaster back in 1980. It's not big ships or even ferries that scare her, Mallory told me. It's the little boats, like the lifeboat that saved her. She gets seasick easily. She does not like being on the water very much and forget underwater. She says you could not pay her enough money to go scuba diving. But then she stops and thinks about it. The 13-year-old girl who spent 10 hours stranded at sea in 1980 turns 50 years old next month. She's planning to spend her birthday on a beach in Mexico. And she says maybe, just maybe, she'll strap on some goggles and a tank and try to conquer her fear of being underwater.